Isabel's mother cried. What's he doing?
Isabel's grandfather popped back up a few meters away, his head appearing and disappearing in the waves.
Lito!
Isabel cried.
Help!
He cried, waving his arms at the Coast Guard ship while at the same time swimming away from it.
Help me!
He yelled.
He jumped in to distract them,
Papi realized.
They'll come for us first, Señor Castillo said.
No, he's in danger of drowning. They have to rescue him,
Amara cried.
This is our chance. Row! Row!
Tears rolled down Isabel's cheek where her grandfather had just kissed her goodbye.
Lito!
She cried again, reaching out for him over the waves.
Don't worry about me, Chabela. If there's one thing I'm good at, it's treading water,
Lito yelled back.
Now row! Mañana is yours, my beautiful songbird. Go to Miami and be free!
Isabel sobbed. She couldn't paddle, couldn't row, couldn't do anything but watch as the Coast Guard ship veered away from their little boat and steered toward her grandfather. Went to save him and send him to Guantanamo, back to Cuba.
Mahmoud, Hungary, 2015. 17 days from home. They came for Mahmoud and his father again the next morning, this time to take them to a crowded refugee camp in a cold, muddy field surrounded by a wire fence. Multicolored camping tents stood among heaps of trash and discarded clothes, and Hungarian soldiers in blue uniforms and white surgical masks guarded the entrances and exits. There was only one real building, a windowless cinder block warehouse filled with row after row of metal cots. Mahmoud and his father found Mom and Walid among the newly arrived refugees, and they shared a tearful reunion. They were each given a blanket and a bottle of water and found cots for themselves. But when the food was delivered, they missed out. The Hungarian soldiers stood at one end of the room, tossing sandwiches into the crowd like zookeepers throwing food to the animals in a cage. And Mahmoud and his family didn't know enough to rush the tables to catch their lunch. Mahmoud expected his father to laugh it off, but he wasn't joking anymore. Instead, Dad sat on his cot, his face and arms purple and bruised, staring off into space. Getting beaten and thrown into prison by the Hungarians had finally broken his spirit. It scared Mahmoud. Of the four members of his family who were left, he was the only one who wasn't broken. His mother had snapped the moment she had handed her daughter away, and now she wandered the maze of mattresses and blankets in the detention center, asking people she had already asked if they had seen or heard of a baby named Hana. Mahmoud's brother, Walid, was broken too. But unlike his mother, he had been broken piece by piece, over time, like someone snapping off little bites of a chocolate bar until there was nothing left. He lay listless on a foam mattress, disinterested in the card games or soccer games the other children were playing. Whatever childish joy he had once possessed had been sucked out until there was nothing left. And now his father was dead inside too. Mahmoud fumed. Why were they even here? Why did the Hungarians care if they were just passing through? Why had they taken them all the way to the Austrian border only to throw them in a detention center? It felt personal somehow, like the whole country was conspiring to keep them from finding a real home. There were policemen with guns at every door. They were more like prisoners than refugees, and when they got out of here, it would just be to go back to Serbia, back to another country that didn't want them. After everything they had been through, they weren't going to make it to Germany after all. But Mahmoud wasn't ready to give up. He wanted life to be like it was before the war had come. They couldn't go back to Syria. Not now. Mahmoud knew that. But there was no reason they couldn't make a new life for themselves somewhere else. Start over. Be happy again. and Mahmoud wanted to do whatever it took to make that happen, or at least try. But making something happen meant drawing attention, being visible. And being invisible was so much easier. It was useful too, like in Aleppo or Serbia or here in Hungary. But sometimes it was just as useful to be visible, like in Turkey and Greece. The reverse was true too, though. Being invisible had hurt them as much as being visible had. Mahmoud frowned. And that was the real truth of it, wasn't it? Whether you were visible or invisible, it was all about how other people reacted to you. Good and bad things happened either way. If you were invisible, the bad people couldn't hurt you, that was true. But the good people couldn't help you either. If you stayed invisible here, did everything you were supposed to, and never made waves, you would disappear from the eyes and minds of all the good people out there who could help you get your life back. It was better to be visible, to stand up, to stand out. Mahmoud watched as a door on a nearby wall opened, and a group of men and women in light blue caps and vests with the letters UN written on them came inside, escorted by some important-looking Hungarian soldiers. Mahmoud knew that the UN was the United Nations, the same group that had been helping people at the Kilis refugee camp. The UN people carried clipboards and cell phones and made notes and took pictures of the living conditions. This place was run by the Hungarians, not the UN, so Mahmoud guessed they were there to observe, to document the living conditions of the refugees. Mahmoud decided, right then and there, he was going to make sure the observers saw him. Mahmoud got up from his cot and walked to the door. All he had to do was push his way through, and he would be outside. But a Hungarian soldier stood guard next to it. She wore a blue uniform, a red cap, and a thick black leather belt that held a nightstick and had all kinds of compartments. Over her shoulder, she carried a small automatic rifle on a strap, the barrel pointed at the gymnasium floor. The guard ignored Mahmoud. He stood right in front of her, but she looked over him, past him. Mahmoud was invisible as long as he did what he was supposed to do, and as long as he was invisible, he was safe, and she was comfortable. It was time for both of those things to change. Mahmoud took a deep breath and pushed the door open. Chuk-chunk! The sound echoed loudly in the big room, and suddenly all the kids stopped playing, and all the adults looked up from their mattresses at him. It was green outside, and sunny, and at first Mahmoud had to squint to see. "Hey!" the guard cried. She saw him now, didn't she? The UN observers did, too. "Stop! No! Not allowed!" the soldier said in bad Arabic. She struggled to find the right words and said something in Hungarian that Mahmoud didn't understand. She started to raise her gun at him, and then she glanced up and saw the frowns on the faces of the UN observers. Mahmoud stepped outside. The woman looked around at the other guards and called out to them, as if asking what to do. Mahmoud took another step, and another. And soon he was away from the building, walking toward the road. Walid ran through the door after him, followed by the rest of the children. The Hungarian guards yelled after them, but they didn't do anything to stop them. "Mahmoud!" Walid said, panting as he ran up alongside his brother. His eyes were bright and alive for the first time Mahmoud could remember. "Mahmoud! What are you doing?" "I'm not staying in that place and waiting for them to send me back to Serbia. Come on," Mahmoud said. "We're walking to Austria."
Joseph. Vornay, France, 1940. 1 year, 1 month, and 10 days from home. Gunfire crackled. An artillery shell whistled overhead and hit with a shuddering thoom somewhere nearby. Ruthie cried, and Joseph's mother hugged her close. Joseph peeked out the window. They were hiding in a tiny schoolhouse in a village called Vornay, somewhere south of Bourges in France. The desks were all in perfect rows, and a long-forgotten assignment was still written on the chalkboard. It was dark outside, and the trees surrounding the schoolhouse made it even darker. That was good. It helped them hide. But it also made spotting German stormtroopers harder. Joseph ducked back down inside, and his eyes fell on a map of Europe on the wall. The various countries shaded different colors. How wrong that map was now, just a year after he and his family had come to France as refugees. Germany had absorbed Austria and conquered Poland and Czechoslovakia soon after. Holland and Belgium and Denmark had fallen to Hitler, and the Nazis occupied the northern half of France, including Paris. All of France had surrendered, but there were still pockets of Free France forces resisting the Nazis throughout the countryside where Joseph and his family were now. The only refugees from the St. Louis who were still safe, Joseph realized, were the ones who had made it to Great Britain, though word was that Hitler was going to try to cross the English Channel any day now. Joseph and his mother and sister were trying to get to Switzerland in the hope that the Swiss would give them refuge. They'd made it this far, traveling by night, sleeping in hay barns and out in fields under the stars, but the Nazis had finally caught up to them. A light played across the window above him, and Joseph chanced to look out again. Stormtroopers, headed toward the school. "They're coming," Joseph told his mother. "We have to go." His mother picked up Ruthie and headed for the door, but Joseph stopped her. There was only one door to the schoolhouse, and the Nazis would be using it. "No, this way," he said. Joseph kept low as he scurried to the back wall of the classroom. There was a window there. They could climb out and run for the woods. He tried the handle. It was stuck. Joseph looked over his shoulder. He could see the beam of a flashlight in the hall outside, could hear the familiar German language of his homeland. They had to get out of there. Joseph threw his elbow against the glass, and it shattered. That brought a cry from the hallway. Joseph knocked the rest of the glass out of the window in a panic. He felt his coat sleeve rip, felt something cold and sharp against his skin, but he didn't have time to think about that. He helped his mother out first, then handed Ruthie out to her through the window. "Go, go," Joseph said, before he was even all the way out the window, and his mother picked up Ruthie and ran for the darkness of the woods. None of them carried suitcases anymore. Those had been left behind long ago. But they all still wore their coats, even though it was the height of summer. His mother had insisted. The only thing any of them still carried was Bitsy, the little stuffed bunny Ruthie had never parted with. It was tucked tightly under Ruthie's arm. Joseph leaped down from the window, stumbled, got back up, and ran. "There! There!" The beam of the flashlight found him. A pistol cracked, and a bullet blew the bark off a tree less than a meter away from him. Joseph stumbled again in panic, righted himself, and kept running. Behind him, the stormtroopers were yelling to each other, barking like dogs after a fox. They were on the scent now and wouldn't let up, not until Joseph and his family had been caught. "There's a house up ahead," his mother yelled over her shoulder. She swerved onto a small dirt lane, and Joseph overtook her, beating her to the door. It was a little French country house, with two windows on either side of a double door in the middle and a chimney on one side. Joseph caught a faint whiff of smoke from the kitchen fire, and a curtain fluttered in the window. Someone was inside. Joseph pounded on the door. He glanced over his shoulder. Three flashlight beams were bouncing up the lane toward them. "Help! Please help us!" Joseph whispered frantically, still pounding. No one answered, and no lights came on inside. "Halt!" came a young man's voice. Joseph spun around. There were four German soldiers behind them. Three of them pointed flashlights at them, making Joseph squint. He could still see well enough to know that two of them had rifles pointed at them. A third carried a pistol. "Hands up! Put the child down!" the stormtrooper told Joseph's mother. Ruthie tried to cling to her, but Mama did as she was told. Dully, Joseph realized that he'd lost some of the feeling in his right arm, and that his sleeve was coated in blood. He'd cut himself on the window glass. Badly. He squeezed the place where his arm had grazed the glass, and the pain was so blinding it almost made him pass out. Ruthie had her head down, crying, but she raised her little bunny's right arm and said, "Heil Hitler!" One of the soldiers laughed, and as he blinked the pain of his arm away, Joseph thought maybe the soldiers would let them go. But one of them said, "Papers!" They were in trouble now, for sure. Their papers had big letter J's stamped all over them. J for Jew.
We don't have papers," Mama said.
One of the soldiers gestured at her, and a stormtrooper with a rifle marched up to them and checked her coat pockets. He quickly found the papers she carried for her and Ruthie, and just as easily found Joseph's papers on him. The soldier brought them back to a man with a flashlight, and he unfolded them.
"Jews," the man said, "from Berlin. You've run a long way from home."
"You have no idea," thought Joseph.
"We're going to Switzerland," Ruthie said.
"Hush, Ruthie," Joseph hissed.
"Switzerland, is that so? Well, I'm afraid we cannot allow that," the soldier said. "You will be taken to a concentration camp, like the rest of the Jews."
"Why," thought Joseph, "why bother hunting us down and taking us back to prison? If the Nazis want us Jews gone so badly, why don't they just let us keep going?" One of the soldiers came toward them with a gun.
"No, wait," Joseph's mother cried. "I have money. Reichsmarks, French francs."
She fumbled inside her shirt where she kept their money hidden. The bills fluttered to the ground. The soldier moved the bills around with his feet and made a tisking sound.
"It is not enough, I'm afraid."
Joseph's heart sank. At the chance she might really be able to buy their way out, Joseph's mother became hysterical.
"Wait, wait, I have jewelry, diamonds!"
She yanked at Ruthie's coat, pulling it off over her head.
"Mama, what are you doing?" Ruthie cried.
Joseph's mother ripped at the seams the way his father had when he'd rent his garments for old Professor Weiler on the ship. From Ruthie's coat, she pulled something that glittered in the light of the electric torches. Earrings. The diamond earrings Joseph's father had bought her for their anniversary one year. Joseph remembered Papa giving them to her, remembered the smile on Mama's face, the light in her eyes, both long gone now. Mama had sewn her earrings into the lining of Ruthie's coat. That was why she had never let Ruthie take it off. The soldier took the earrings from Joseph's mother and examined them in the light. Joseph held his breath. Maybe they would let his mother buy their way out of this after all.
"Everything I was able to keep," his mother said. "It's all yours. Just please, let us go."
"These are very nice," the soldier said. "But I think there is only enough here to buy freedom for one of your children."
But that's all I have left," Mama said.
The soldier looked at her expectantly. At first, Joseph didn't understand what he wanted. They didn't have anything else to give him. But then, the Nazi pulled Joseph and Ruthie to him and turned them around for Mama to see, and that's when Joseph understood. The Nazi didn't care how much money they had, how many jewels. It wasn't about that. He was playing with them. This was another game, like a cat playing with a mouse before he ate it. "I think there is only enough here to buy freedom for one of your children." One of Rachel Landau's children would go free, and one of her children would go into the camps. The Nazi soldier smiled at Joseph's mother. "You choose."
Isabel, Miami Beach, Florida, 1994. 5 days from home. Here, in this boat that had been her home for 4 days and four nights, Isabel's little brother was born. Not right away. First had come her mother's frantic pushing, pushing, pushing to bring the baby into the world, while the rest of them paddled, paddled, paddled. All but Señora Castillo, who sat on the bench next to Mommy, holding her hand and talking her through it. Behind them, the Coast Guard had finished picking up Isabel's grandfather and was headed their way, lights flashing. Their little blue boat was close to the shore. The waves around them were breaking with white caps. Isabel could see people dancing on the beach. but they weren't close enough. Weren't going to make it. That's when